Welcome to episode 95 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. Eric Borzeski here, Alan Olson elsewhere.
Yo.
Brought together by the magic of the internet.
It's a wonderful thing.
Well, we went to a British Open, and number one player in the world had the lead for 3 days. Of course, it was number one player in the world for 10 years ago or so. This is what happens when Tiger Woods is away. We get 53-year-olds winning major championships or leading them through 63 holes.
Utterly bizarre is about the only way I can sum it up. Yeah, 53-year-olds leading the thing. You know, Tom Watson shooting a couple. He almost makes the cut. It's like we hit the rollback machine for 15 years ago.
But in the end, it was the guy that won it last year that puts together a great back nine, shooting 32. On the inward par 36-9 at Royal Birkdale, Padraig Harrington puts away his second consecutive British Open and elevates himself into somewhat elite status and jumps to number three in the world rankings. And in many people's minds, he could be number two. He's won two of the last five major championships. Phil Mickelson, zero.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point you could probably say he is the second best player in the world. Certainly wins, he wins the big matches, unlike a lot of the other guys.
It's tough to say what was more impressive, but I'll ask you that question. What was more impressive, Padraig Harrington's win or Greg Norman finishing T3 and contending and, in fact, leading through 63 holes again?
I'd have to say Greg Norman. I mean, I know Padraig was hurt with his wrist and stuff, but Greg Norman's basically, what has he done in the last 10 years for golf?
He's played tennis.
Exactly. He's played tennis and whatnot.
Made
and
wine.
Wine. Clothes, yachts, hell, anyway. I think horses. It's, I mean, he comes out of nowhere. I mean, when was the last time he played a competitive round? I mean, I can't think of the last time I've seen Greg Norman on TV.
The senior whatever, right?
Yeah.
At Oak Hill in Rochester.
So
that's
for
about him, it, and he kind of gave up there, so.
Yeah, and for him to come in with the conditions the way they were and go 70-70-72, that's unbelievable. You're thinking Tiger's gone, so you'd think Jim Furyk and Ernie Els and...
And 77 wasn't a bad score on the final round. It's just that Padraig Harrington overtook him with a fairly spectacular 69.
Oh, man, that was incredible. Some of the shots he hit on the back nine there. It was just unbelievable. Just hunting at flags from 240 out with a 5-wood.
Yeah, and a sloppy 7th, 8th, and 9th hole led to bogeys on each of those for Padraig Harrington, or else his 69 could have been shockingly good. Otherwise, 67, I believe, was the low round of the day on Sunday at the British Open. That was shot by David Howell, perhaps a few others, but 75 points, I think, was about the scoring average. Phil Mickelson, T19, some of the names that jump out at you. Ian Poulter had a great tournament, finishing second, and in fact, looked like he could be, I called him a 50% chance to win when Padraig was back on perhaps the 13th hole or so.
Oh, he had some huge clutch 10 to 15 foot putts that he just drained him, and you're thinking, going, okay, what's he going to do? Is he going to win? Are we going to get a playoff?
He three putted 17 for a par.
Yeah, that
hurt him.
Yeah, that was pretty bad for as great of a drive and the second shot as he had to three putt. That was kind of inexcusable at that point.
But made a great about 15, maybe 18-foot putt for par on the 18th hole. So closed fairly strongly. Also shot 69 in the final round, which under those conditions, anybody breaking par deserves a round of applause.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just incredible, though, just to see some of these guys that went out earlier in the day, who maybe were in the 20s and 30s, all of a sudden top 10.
Right. Some of the people that snuck up there, finished the day a long time before, and yet, David Howell with a 67 runs way up the leaderboard. He finishes at plus 12, but that's good enough for a T7,
mm-hmm.
along with Robert Carlson, who shot a 69. Anthony Kim slipped a bit with a 75, but he finishes T7. Steve Stricker shoots 73 and moves up. I think I saw about one golf shot that Steve Stricker hit all week, and he finishes top 10.
Well, with as great as the TV coverage was,
yeah,
it was hard to see most of the golfers on the course.
No, we got more shots of Chris Everett than we got of Steve Stricker. Other guys in the top 10, Henrik Stenson, a very nice T3 with a final round 71. Shot his worst round in the first round, a 76, then followed it up with 72, 70, and 71. Jim Furyk and the amateur Chris Wood tied for 5th, and others tied for 7th. Robert Allaby, everybody's favorite guy, Stephen Ames, Paul Casey, Ben Curtis, Ernie Els, 80, 69, 74, 69. So two pair of 69s for Ernie after shooting a 10 over a round, 80 in the first round.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. He pretty much rode him off. I mean, where's Ernie? Then all of a sudden it was like, oh yeah, he finished like 3 hours before anybody teed off on Sunday, and he finishes T7.
KJ Choi balloons to a final round 79, playing in the penultimate pairing.
That was a little bit surprising to see him blow up to a 79 on that day. I would have thought he would have just fairways greens and plugged along, but just wasn't his day.
Yeah, so early picks for the PGA Championship have to include whoever's most injured, because we get Trevor Immelman in the Masters coming off a cyst removal or, you know, some almost cancer-like thing that he had. I forget what he had, you know, on his diaphragm or something back in December that was basically almost life-threatening. Tiger Woods with a non-existent knee and leg, basically. And Patrick Harrington with a wrist that seemed to get better every day, but still injured to start the week. So it's the year of the injured golfer, apparently.
Whoever's on crutches the week before the PGA, that's who I'm picking.
Phil Mickelson will be throwing himself down a flight of stairs or something.
What will Phil do next?
That's right. We'll be right back. That's what we'll do next.
I marked my Titleist with a black dot over the number one.
With two blue dots.
With a red line through the Titleist.
With a DH over the Titleist.
Just two little dots.
I mark my golf ball pretty simply.
It's kind of complicated.
Bowling orange with a striped black line.
Just like this.
Two dots with a black dot over the number.
Out on tour.
It's not how you mark your golf ball.
It's how you mark your Titleist.
How do you mark your Titleist?
The forum topic of the week was given to us by Rich F., who linked us to a couple good articles quoting from Jack Nicklaus, who's wondering about today's golfer being soft due to the prize money. It is pretty interesting. This was written by Doug Ferguson from the Associated Press. Jack comes out and says, for the youth, if they don't win, they still walk home with a big check. They don't have to do some of the things the Watsons had to do, the Normans, the Laymans, and that's to gut it out. Doesn't mean the young guys will be out of it. Just appears as though the guys who have had that experience are coming to the top.
Yeah, and, you know, I agree with Jack. You know, it's ironic a bit that Jack says these things as he flies over in his private jet and flies back, and as he jet sets around the world and gets paid a few million dollars to design golf courses, but he's not exactly the representative of the typical tour guy, obviously, either. But, you know, you see this, and I think there's two classes of player. I think there's the Brett Quigleys of the world who have never won and likely never will and seem to be happy and perfectly content to finish second when they have a good week, or if they're anywhere near the lead on Sunday to fall back, and if they're back to surge forward and earn a good check and be content with that. And then I think you have the guys who genuinely want to win, and they may not always pull it out, but I think just to throw a name out there, I think Ryan Moore is one of those types of guys. He's had a winning record in the past. I think it bothers him that he's yet to win. I think it bothers Anthony Kim that he's won maybe only twice. Maybe he feels he should have won a few more times. You know, I think there are some that are driven to win, and those are the types of guys that I am drawn to as a fan. And then I think Jack's right, and that there are a lot of guys who are just content to finish top 10, earn a good paycheck, keep their tour cards for year after year after year without even winning anything, and earn a good living. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, it doesn't exactly make me a fan of that kind of player.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, definitely there is that two-tiered system. And I don't know. I mean, the other thing is, you know, Jack, again, is talking about, I think the quote was, kids today play perfect conditions every week. If they don't like what's going on, they're finishing 10th or 15th and still make a check, as opposed to the older guys who had to gut it out in tough course conditions. So I don't know if he's really saying that the courses they played back in his day were, it's not like they were playing the local Muni.
Right. They were as good as they could be back then. And the weather obviously is no different now than it used to be back then either. So I'm not sure what's up with that. We've had bad weather in the Masters the past few years, and the guys have gutted it out and stuff. There were probably just as many complaints back then as there are now. And Jack is famous for saying he loved it when it was bad weather, because anyone that complained about it, he wrote them off in his mind as not being able to contend that week because they were too busy worrying about things they couldn't control. So I don't know that there's much truth to that part of it, but I do agree with him about the money.
Oh yeah, there's so much money out there that it's, like you said, I mean, it doesn't take a lot to keep, $500,000 keeps your tour card.
Well, not anymore.
Now it's closer to $1 million, but it doesn't take a lot for these guys to be able to get up there if you finish top 15, top 20 every week and not really have to,
You need three top 10 finishes on the PGA Tour to keep your card. We'll be back.
I mark my Titleist with three red dots around the number.
Three crosses around the script.
With my initials.
With two blue dots. A black dot here.
Here and here.
Just like that.
With my family's initials.
With an R and a K.
With three blue dots.
Red dot.
Un pequeño círculo.
Out on tour.
It's not how you mark your golf ball.
It's how you mark your Titleist.
How do you mark your Titleist?
And we're back with John Daly. John Daly, who finished plus 29. In fact, of the guys that made the cut, only one guy finished worse, even though he had to play two more rounds than John Daly. Some Chinese guy, I think, that I've never heard of finished at plus 31. But John Daly shoots an 89, 19 over in the second round. But that's not what we're even going to talk about. Heck no, we're going to talk about John Daly's press conference.
Yes, John Daly. What a lovely press conference that it was. If you haven't been around the last week, it's him and Butch Harmon. Round two, or is it round three?
And this was unprompted. You know, they asked John Daly why we haven't seen him in a while, or why he hasn't gotten a sponsor's invitation, and he said, well, Butch Harmon lied and basically ruined my life for a while.
Yeah, I think John Daly's pretty much done a pretty good job of himself doing that.
I'm getting sick and tired of John Daly blaming everyone else. Butch Harmon, to this point, has been the one guy to stand up and say, you know what, dude, take some accountability. I'm not going to enable you. You have enough people doing that for you already, and... You know, this is, I'm not sure I've ever seen a worse case than John Daly in the public. You know, I'm sure there are some drunks out there or whatever that are worse off and more delusional than John Daly. But in the public eye, I don't think I've ever seen it.
This is just bizarre. I mean, he's past the point. I mean, for a while they're like, oh, it's just John being John. And at this point, I mean, he's not even a novelty. I mean, who wants him at the tournament? I mean, when he acts like this. So, yeah, right. I'm tired of him.
All right. Well, then we're done then. Michelle Wee. Disqualified.
Speaking of being done,
Michelle Wee gets disqualified in the State Farm Classic. She was disqualified for not signing her scorecard after Friday's round. She was one shot back after Saturday's round. Officials didn't find out about the infraction until play had already started on Saturday, so she was invited to share her side of the story, and then since it matched the side of the story told by the volunteers, she was disqualified for not signing her scorecard. She had actually left the scoring area, which is when you are deemed to have turned your scorecard in to the committee. Volunteer said, oh no, she didn't sign her scorecard, ran out, got her signature, and came back. At that point, it was too late. So, but, you know, there are a number of funny things here, though. One, Michelle Wee needs to know that you sign your scorecard. I mean, that's the whole point of being in the scoring tent. That's why you're there. You sign your scorecard. Two, why is there not a scoring official? Why are there only volunteers in these scoring tents? The PGA Tour puts a scoring official in there. The majors certainly have a scoring official in there, an actual official. You know, and if there are volunteers, why are they not told nobody leaves his tent without signing their card? They let Michelle Wee leave. And it was still Michelle Wee's fault for leaving to begin with. This is not a dumb rule. You know, I don't care that we have everyone knows what score people shot, because, you know, you can't have separate rules for tournaments where people, you know, there's internet scoring and live scoring and TV and walking scorers and your club championship. You can't have separate rules for that. So signing your card is like the simple way of saying, this is what I shot. I attest to it. The end. So it's not a stupid rule, and I'm not even going to entertain debate on that. But what the heck? She was likely going to win the tournament. She hadn't shot around in the 70s yet, and all she needed was a 71, I think, on Sunday to win an LPGA event, get her tour card, the end, if she wanted it. But instead, she's disqualified, and she earns zip, and, you know, it's a learning experience. But how many of these does this girl need?
It's just utterly bizarre. I mean, if this happens to anybody else, you just kind of go, eh, okay, that's fine, honest mistake. It just continues to pile on for her. And, you know, I think some of her quotes were, she said she usually signs her scorecard immediately and had no idea why she didn't on Friday. Why, you know, why not on Friday? I mean, that's just not a very good reason. Betsy King said that she always had her caddy stand over her when she turned in the scorecard, making sure nothing was missed. You know, where was her caddy?
Right.
You know, you brought up a great point about the LPGA just having volunteers in a scoring tent rather than having an official going, sign this. You know, and there again, Michelle Wee's been, you know, she's been pushed into playing tournaments. She's been on a public stage for, you know, what feels like forever at this point. I think by now she's signed enough scorecards to know, check your score, sign it, and you move on. So, I don't know.
It's a little known rule, too. Your scorecard is not turned in until you leave the tent. You can sign your scorecard on the first tee. It doesn't matter. You're not, the signature doesn't attest, it doesn't lock anything in. When you leave the scoring area, that's when you're defined to have turned your scorecard in. So you can sign it whenever you want. So perhaps you better just start signing it on the first tee from now on, because it's allowed and it doesn't change anything. And so I time and time again, it's Michelle Wee with something dumb. This one, you know, a rule is a rule, and she broke it. The previous one with Michael Bamberger, you know, you can go back to our podcast on that. I thought that was a bit silly to have done it a day later when, you know, she had officials walking with her. She had her playing partners and opponents and everything in the group. And, you know, they said it was, the drop was fine and whatever. So you can go back to that. But this clearly should have been a DQ, and it was. And yet it shouldn't have been an issue at all. You know, the number of golfers that have ever fallen to this rule can probably be counted on one hand in the past decade or two. And then hot on the heels of that, we learned that she's going to be playing with the men again.
Oh, goody.
And if I could make a sound of my head hitting the desk out of just whatever, I would. It would sound like that. There you go.
Yeah, that was my head.
It's an opposite field event. It's opposite the Bridgestone Invitational. So she's not playing against even the top, 100 guys in the world, or 70, top 70 guys in the world. It's the Reno Tahoe Open. I think Fred Funk is playing in it. It's a second-tier event. But come on.
Well, we saw...
Just when there was hope. We thought she might be listening, or her parents might be paying attention. Just when we thought there was hope, she gets disqualified, and then she announces she's playing with the men.
Yeah, it looked like she was finally starting to mature and play better golf and not do these silly things. And
it's like she submitted to a Stanford psychology test or something, where some Stanford psych major is using her as her thesis subject or something.
That's the only way this can happen. I have no clue. This just boggles my mind. Coming off the heels of the DQ, you're going to go, oh, I should go play a men's event. That'd be great. So what's going to happen?
Guess when what? They make you sign your scorecards there, too.
Well, at least there'll be an official there to help her. Hold her hand, give her a crayon, whatever.
That was kind of mean.
It was. But at this point, I just think this is a colossal mistake. And with somebody whose psyche appears to be fragile, what's she going to do when she goes out there? If she makes the cut, okay, I guess I'll be eating some crow. But if she comes in last and misses the cut, what's that really doing for her?
I don't know.
She's only got one sponsor's exemption, so maybe this is a practice round for her. It just seems to be kind of a pretty big stage to be practicing on.
Right. Well, that about does it for episode 95. Click the links to all the things we've talked about in our show notes online. And for Alan Olson, this is Eric Borsowski saying bye-bye.